Govindan, I'm kind of curious, too, the faculty in the second situation would bring in BEV, and it brings, in general, the issue of BEV. An issue that was raised by a couple of the docs is the fact that BEV, from their point of view, provides a lot of benefit to patients with effusions, particularly persistent pleural effusions. And so the question that we heard was, if you have a patient like that, is there a way to integrate BEV into first-line therapy with a checkpoint inhibitor, with chemotherapy? And is that something you would ever consider?
Not for squamous, Neil. I think the concerns are real with bleeding, as was demonstrated in the earlier study years ago. In the non-squamous, I think legitimately one can consider that, but you know, we have prospective data to suggest that the combination of the four-drug regimen was better than the control arm of chemotherapy with bevacizumab alone. But the challenge is with four drugs, the toxicities get to be a little prohibitive. So I've not embraced that regimen. Regarding the comment about the pleural effusion, that's an interesting one. In fact, the VEGF used to be called VPF, vascular permeability factor, and I think there is some suggestion that this could decrease the effusion. And in fact, the brain tumor doctors use it all the time to decrease the edema with single-agent bevacizumab. But I've not been so persuaded to do it. Today, we can do PLURAX and take care of the effusions reasonably well. But if that's the reason to use the four-drug regimen, which we have some prospective data for, and the patient is a candidate for that, I would have no objection to that.
You're talking about the Empower regimen that utilizes atezolizumab, which is approved. Right. But, you know, getting back also to this issue, Eddie, of using anti-angiogenic in squamous and non-squamous, another question we got is, why is it that you can use ramucirumab in squamous cell, but you can't use BEV? Now, I know you have the clinical data that supports that, but I'm just kind of curious, Eddie, whether you have any hypotheses, whether you think there actually is a difference, or maybe it's just the way the trials were done. Any thoughts about this issue of risk of bleeding with ramucirumab in squamous cell, for example?
So I actually think there is a difference. If you look at those early studies of bevacizumab in squamous cell carcinoma, it was a very significant number of patients with hemoptysis, and that is of concern. Now, there's one question is whether sort of with learning over time, people knew on the ramucirumab study to keep patients off, but at least if you assume that the selection was similar, they clearly are different. I think in terms of mechanism, it's very difficult. People have argued that since really the ligand is the target for bevacizumab, but in ramucirumab, it's the VEGF receptor, maybe that could have something to do with it. I think in the end, we don't know. And whether or not the exclusion of central lesions in the docetaxel ramucirumab study is responsible for this, I think is hard to know. But the one thing I think we can safely say is that the results for pulmonary hemorrhage that were seen between studies of bevacizumab and ramucirumab really were different. It was a phase two study of bevacizumab where they were excluded. And again, it is possible that it really is just the issue that in the ramucirumab study that they were not including patients with central tumors. But the difference between the studies is real.
So, Govindan, the other thing that's interesting to me about that Empower study is it does combine an IO and an anti-angiogenic. So in this case, atezolizumab and bevacizumab. That combination just took over as first-line therapy of hepatocellular cancer. And we see other situations where anti-angiogenics and IO have been very effective, particularly TKIs. So, for example, lenvatinib, pembrolizumab, for example, in endometrial cancer. Any comment, Govindan, in general about the synergy between anti-angiogenics and checkpoint inhibitors and whether that's a strategy that you think can be further exploited?
That's a great point, Neil. I think one interesting hypothesis is that the VEGF inhibition leads to decrease in myeloid-derived suppressive cells and may resculpt the tumor microenvironment in a more favorable way. So there is some interesting science behind this, and there have been studies conducted ongoing, completed, where patients who progressed on a checkpoint inhibitor were then given a combination of a checkpoint inhibitor with a multikinase inhibitor. And anecdotally, we have seen some dramatic responses in a few patients in lung cancer with that combination, having progressed on a checkpoint inhibitor before. But after seeing data from a variety of cancers, it seems to be quite dramatic in renal cell and hepatocellular cancer. It's unclear whether this strategy will pan out long-term in non-small cell lung cancer.
So John Haymock explained to us why EGFR mutated lung cancer biologically, Eddie, in his eyes, is similar to renal cell, which I never heard before, somehow through the HIF mechanism. But I am just curious, Eddie, what your thoughts are about using further immunotherapy, as Govinda was just sort of citing. For example, a situation like this, a patient who, after having a response, progresses on immunotherapy. Any strategies for follow-up? Govinda was talking about adding an anti-angiogenic. Obviously, people think about ipi-nivo, although I don't know there's much data to support that. Any other immune strategies you can think about or being tested beyond first line, Eddie?
Well, there clearly are many such strategies being tested. I think in terms of outside of a trial, I have not been using immune strategies. I think the one that is questioned, and I think nobody knows, is whether, for instance, in a patient who would have received frontline pembrolizumab, should you continue an immune checkpoint inhibitor when they get the chemotherapy? I don't know of data on ipilimumab and nivolumab in a salvage setting. I know that we did present data on durvalumab and tremolimumab in patients who had progressed on a PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor, and the response rate in that setting was 5%. So that is a strategy that I tend to be somewhat skeptical of until I see data that would show that it really induces a significant response rate.
Julie, your former colleague, Chuck Drake, who then moved to Columbia, used to tell me about these other checkpoints, TIM lag. Anything there in terms of, again, either synergy up front or using the relapse setting, any trials, any trial data that has you interested?
So far, the TIM-3 data, at least in lung cancer in the metastatic setting, has had some small numbers of response, but relatively low. And the same for lag-3, though each one of us probably has a patient where that combination seems to have worked, but I think trying to figure out why. I think looking at some of the bispecific combinations in the near future may be helpful, taking a checkpoint blockade and then bringing the T cell to the tumor. There's various different newer agents coming out that are quite interesting. But again, most of these are in phase 1 studies. Bispecific is basically having a PD-1 or PD-L1 on one side of the antibody and another on the other side is either CTLA-4 or one of those other checkpoints.
Wow, that's interesting.